Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, strange coincidence, because as I was preparing for today's show, I have two fiction authors joining me today, both New York Times bestselling authors. And I wanted to just go back and listen to the last podcasts to make sure we didn't repeat similar kind of information. And I realized that both of my guests that are appearing today both appeared on the same show this time last year. So it was kind of a coincidence. But as I said, they're both New York Times bestselling authors who both write historical novels, but with a different twist. Coming up around 12:40, we'll talk with New York Times bestselling author MJ Rose. She's known as a reincarnationist who weaves a true historical figure into her stories. There's always a true character in there at some point. And she describes her latest book as having more of a gothic spin. It's called The Witch of Painted Sorrows, and it's set against the backdrop of Paris in the 1890s. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome back Hazel Gaynor. She's joining us from the Emerald Hills of Ireland, very appropriate, since Seattle, of course, is known as the Emerald City. And Hazel Gaynor is the author of New York Times and USA Today bestselling novel, The Girl Who Came Home. As a freelance writer, her writing's been featured in the Sunday Times Magazine and Irish Times. And as a feature writer for the national Irish website, writing.ie, she's interviewed Philippa Gregory, Sebastian Faulks, Cheryl Strayed, and others. Hazel received the 2012 Cecil Day Lewis Award for Emerging Writers and appeared as a guest speaker at the Romantic Novelist Association Conference and the Historical Novel Society Conference in 2014. Library Journal named her a big breakout author for 2015, and her latest book is called Memory of Violets, a novel of London's flower cellars. Hazel Gaynor, welcome.
Hi, Vicki. Thank you so much for having me on the show. What an introduction.
Well, it's great to have you back. And boy, I can't believe it's been a year since you were with us. And you were then a debut novelist. And so much has happened to you since then. So let's just...
I know. It's been a real completely crazy year. I mean, who would have thought when I was standing here a year ago, not even a full year, but just fantastic. Yeah, I couldn't have asked for more.
Well, I brought home to one of my friends because she saw you were on the show and she said, I remember Hazel because she was fascinated by your story. You worked really hard to get published. You had a difficult time getting published, and then when you did, it just took off. Mm. And my friend was close to finishing her novel, and she's still close to finishing the same novel.
keep going.
Yeah, she said it gave her a boot in the posterior, as she put it.
Very good.
But I wanted to, let's just talk a little bit about this book, A Memory of Violets, a novel of London's flower cellars. Fascinating story. And I was reading about how, well, first of all, you found it very difficult to write a second novel. You said you read in a blog post, I understand now why the Sex Pistols only recorded one album. So tell us a little bit about the journey from the great success you had with A Girl Who Came Home, which was a story based on the Titanic, to writing this second novel and the expectations around it and your expectations, the expectations of your publishers, of your readers. I mean, what was all that like for you?
Yeah, and it is one of those sort of fascinating things, because I think when you're writing your first novel, you really are writing, I used to describe it as sort of writing blind. You know, you just have this complete faith, I suppose, within yourself, or a real passion for the story that you want to tell, or you're chasing a dream or something, and there's something that just keeps you writing when you have no guarantee whatsoever of that book ever being published, or if it is published, you know, if it will be successful or how it will be received. And I think that's a fascinating thing about debut novelists, that they've somehow managed to keep going. So as your friend is doing, keep going, despite right. No guarantee at the end of it. So you know, when that finally came for me after 5 years of trying and the rejection, and I'm now able to look back on that with hindsight and the distance of that sort of painful experience, and actually I've learned an awful lot from having had to keep going and having had to overcome those rejections. So then when it comes to a second novel, especially because The Girl Who Came Home had been so successful, and, you know, what an absolute pleasure that experience was. So for me, in producing A Memory of Violet, there was, yes, the expectation of myself, as you say, of the publisher, but I think my biggest sense of expectation was from my readers, you know, because I had people, which is a lovely thing to be able to say, who were anticipating the next novel. So they'd read The Girl Who Came Home and they were coming back to me with just the most wonderful feedback and lovely comments and saying, you know, when's your next one? And that's just an amazing thing for a writer, to know that there are people waiting for your next book. But on the flip side, it's also terrifying.
Right, because, right.
You know, if somebody's enjoyed your first novel, you really want them to enjoy your second, and subsequently, you want to keep them with you, you know? And this wasn't a sequel. Obviously, it's still historical. But it's two very different subject matters and two very different stories. So, yeah, so I completely get the whole Sex Pistols. We'll just put one album out and then we'll run away and live on that for the rest of our time. So, yeah, I did write a blog post about... And also, I think there's a sense of people thinking it's a little bit as well like a second pregnancy, that, oh, you'll be fine, you've done this all before.
Right.
You know what you're doing. And you actually don't. you've
right.
forgotten what you're doing. You still get the morning sickness. You still feel uncomfortable. And there's a definite analogy there with the second book as well. People sort of think, oh, look, we'll leave her be, she's grand. And you're just as terrified and just as nervous as you were the first time. So
right. And circumstances are different too as well. I mean, you know, different topic, different research. I mean, it's a whole different ball game, really.
It is, absolutely. And plus, you know, you're still, to some degree, promoting your earlier novel, you know, and I'm seeing that now that I'm moving on to writing my third novel, and I'm always talking about, obviously, my current novel, A Memory of Violet, mm-hmm. and still, when, you know, situations arise, discussing The Girl Who Came Home. So, you know, you really start to have to balance all of those. You sort of look after your family of books, as it were, which is,
right.
You know, what a great place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a lovely way of looking at your family of books. So let's look at where the germ of the idea came from, because I think that's always interesting to people, you know, what inspired this. And I read that back in 2010, you had somewhat of a notion to write a book about flower sellers in London. You said perhaps it was driven by my love of Eliza Doolittle.
Yeah.
So talk to us about where that whole idea came from.
Yeah, so very much. When I was 17, I played the role of Eliza Doolittle in the high school musical production of My Fair Lady. And I just absolutely loved the character, the period. That's such an amazing creation of George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion. And I think having studied her in such depth, it really stayed with me. So when I was working on The Girl Who Came Home, I'm constantly picking up ideas and sort of starting to scribble plots for a new book. And I had started to think about that whole world of London in the late Victorian era and the street sellers. And I wanted to try and find who the real Eliza Doolittles were. How would a young woman have found themselves in that sort of situation, living this desperately harsh and unforgiving mm-hmm. life on the streets, selling flowers, selling posies of violets, and selling watercress in the wintertime when the flowers weren't in bloom. And it really was from that seed of Eliza, and started to research the period and street life, and uncovered these incredible true stories of young women, but particularly what struck a chord with me was very young children, many of whom were orphaned or physically disabled or blind, and they were out on the streets selling little posies of flowers to the ladies and gentlemen at the theatre and the opera houses. And I just found this heartbreaking. And I think I hadn't really appreciated, you know, Eliza's story is very romanticized,
yes.
Cinderella.
Yeah.
And the reality behind that was just far from that image, really, that we see of her. And I discovered the work of a man called John Groom, who lived around the flower markets in London at the time. This was the late 1800s and just sort of tipping into the early 1900s. And he took it upon himself to try and help them by setting up homes for them to live in, to take them off the street, to give them a sense of family, which none of them had. And he taught them how to make artificial flowers in a little workroom in his chapel that he preached in. And I just found this incredible. And the more I researched his history and the history of what became known as his flower girls, I just knew immediately that my sort of idea of Eliza Doolittle and this world that of harsh reality that I discovered and his intervention would just make for a fascinating historical novel. So similarly to how I did with The Girl Who Came Home, I took the basis of fact, but I created my own fictional world and my fictional characters around all of that. So it was just amazing to spend time researching all of that.
Yeah, I think there is this Hollywood version, because when you say London flower sellers, all I really know of that, of course, was from that era, is the movie Oliver, which was very romanticized, yes. About
yeah.
that. But very different world. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about a little bit more about John Groom, who became your character Albert Shaw. And a little bit more about your protagonist. We'll talk a little bit more about the book. You're listening
Great,
to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Hazel Gaynor. She's joining us from Ireland today. Her book is called A Memory of Violets, a novel of London's flower sellers. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun. Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest is New York Times bestselling author of The Girl Who Came Home, Hazel Gaynor. Her latest book is called A Memory of Violets, a novel of London's flower sellers. And it's a beautiful cover for your book. I know you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, Hazel, but it's a beautiful cover and it's beautifully written too and very well researched. And you were sharing a little before the break about how, you know, our Hollywood image of flower sellers and Eliza Doolittle is just that, a Hollywood image. It's a very different situation. Many of the kids who actually ended up, and that John Groom, the real character that you were talking about earlier, ended up helping. I mean, they actually grew up working in factories, which, you know, anybody who knows anything about the Industrial Revolution, those conditions were horrific, and many of them were disabled or injured beyond repair. And in those days, there was a lot of discrimination around disability.
Absolutely, you know, and it, you know, if you think about the very sort of stiff and starchy impression that we have of the Victorian era, and you know, when you set that against these destitute, you know, there were huge pockets of desperately poor communities across London, and they were known as the rookeries, where the very, very poor slum housing. And actually, many of those were inhabited by Irish communities who had left Ireland trying to come to London to find work in the factories, which is why my two little orphaned sisters, Rosie and Florrie, are Irish. That was the connection there. But yeah, we really, I suppose, now there's so much positivity around, you know, disability and people who are physically disabled, and that's really set against this, as you say, the real prejudice, and there was no real compassion. You know, people were just left to go and fend for themselves. As you say very rightly, many of the children had worked in factories and maybe had a horrific accident which left them with only one limb or you know, desperately injured in some way, and there was just no way for society to help them. So really all they had left to do was go and find work on the streets, you know, the worst of all possible environments. And many wouldn't have a loving family to go home to. You know, they possibly had one parent survived, and you know, there were desperate stories of alcoholism, you know, within particularly the father of the family. So, yeah, there was nothing really to help these young children, young women, and so therefore the work of somebody like John Groom, who observed all of this happening around his home, and, you know, a real entrepreneur, you know, there were very few people, Dr. Bernardo would have been another, but very few people who had it within themselves to sort of separate themselves from this prejudice about the disabilities and, you know, the polio and all these awful diseases that the children have had, and try to actually improve the lives of these people. And, you know, really trailblazing from that regard, and,
right,
and setting up charitable concern to try and help them,
right,
which really moved me. You know, when I read it, it's so different to how things are today, I'd like to think. You know, so such an incredible man, and his charity still exists today under the name of Livability. So what a legacy,
yeah,
to have left, you know, that over 100 years later, his work is still ongoing.
Yeah, well, I read that that your character Albert Shaw is based on John Groom.
Mm-hmm.
Shaw, you took the name from George Bernard Shaw. Tell us a little bit about the character Albert Shaw, and then I'd like to talk about Tilly and the two Irish sisters.
Yeah, so I purposely wanted to create my own version of John Groom. I didn't want this to be, you know, sort of an autobiographical account of his life, and the novelist within me wanted the freedom to introduce different aspects to the concept of this man's life. So I created the character of Albert Shaw, who is very closely based, really, on John Groom, but he's a very kind-hearted, very benevolent man. He strikes a very imposing figure. He's incredibly tall, and he goes around in a black frock coat, you know, a tail coat, and wears this huge top hat, which my little girls think looks like a chimney pot. You know, you can only imagine them seeing this amazing man. And just how astonished they were when he approached them, the little girls, to offer them to come to his little room that he'd set up to give them a cup of cocoa and a piece of bread and butter. And he had Christian ladies who would talk to the little girls about, you know, being religious and trying to be wholesome and goodly in their life. And he really just completely transformed the lives. The youngest of the children that he helped were taken to an orphanage in Clacton-on-Sea on the south coast. And again, this concept of fresh sea air and just being able to see the sky, because obviously the smog and the fogs in London were desperate. And he, I really paint him as a father figure to these lost children and women. And he creates this family environment. The girls lived in homes of 12. And they really, in my head, they all became sort of squabbling sisters, you know, who right. really depended on each other. But you can imagine the sort of the funny little incidents that would have gone on amongst them.
Right.
But he's this incredibly caring, kind, gentle man who they all have such a huge amount of respect and admiration for. And, you know, his story actually is continued at the end of the book in a sort of a postscript section, which is my imagined memoirs of Albert Shaw. So we kind of get to hear from his personal first-person point of view, looking back over the story that I've just painted. So hopefully that's interesting for readers as well.
Yes, well, I certainly found it interesting. I love when authors put that kind of stuff at the back of the book. So here's the only character that's based on a real person, if you will. So let's talk about Tilly Harper, who leaves the beautiful Lake District. Who'd want to leave the Lake District, but we're talking different times, right?
Yeah.
And of course, we've got Beatrix Potter to thank for the Lake District, because she saved that. Oh my gosh, that woman was incredible. She saved that whole area. So Tilly Harper goes in 1912. She takes off, leaves her sheltered home. She becomes an assistant house mother at Mr. Shaw's home for watercress and flower girls. So tell us what drove her down there and what went on with Tilly when she got there.
Yeah, so we meet Tilly. She's a young woman, early 20s, and we meet her. She's on a train and hurtling down from the beauty of the Lake District to smog-bound London to start this new position. And we get a sense from Tilly very early on that she has some secret in her past, and that life at home hasn't been as she would have hoped that it would be. Her relationship with her sister and her mother particularly is very strained. So we take Tilly's journey with her down to London, and on the train she meets this very wealthy lady, and there's an interesting interaction between them which something up for later in the novel. And when Tilly arrives at Violet House, which is the house that she's going to be helping to care for this dozen girls under Mr. Shaw's charity, she in her bedroom discovers a wooden box, and in the wooden box are a number of very little personal trinkets, a button, a little rag doll, a lace handkerchief, and a journal. And she starts to read this journal, and she discovers that this is written by a young flower seller who was taken into the care of Mr. Shaw 40 years earlier, and her name was Florrie. And Florrie tells this heartbreaking story of having become separated from her little sister Rosie, and Tilly becomes completely drawn into this story of Florrie and Rosie. And as we read on through these journal entries with Tilly, we start to understand not only more about Florrie and Rosie's story, but more about Tilly's story and how different her relationship with her sister is in the Lake District compared to these two little sisters who had nothing at all and were so utterly dependent on each other, and how desperate Florrie is to know what became of her lost little sister.
Right.
And Tilly's a very, I hope she's a very warm, slightly conflicted character. You know, she's certainly not perfect. But that as she sort of becomes more aware of herself, really, and starts to accept her past, we start to understand who she is, and we really want the best for her, I hope. So I really loved creating Tilly, and we follow her back later on in the novel. She takes a trip back home to the Lake District, which is one of my favourite parts of England. I've spent many family holidays mm-hmm. there, and I just love drawing on that beautiful landscape, and it's really a part of Tilly. She sort of almost is the landscape at times.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, she was a great character to create from my imagination.
And so when you were writing this, I think every time an author goes through, you know, creating great characters, which you've done, you know, that they're all great characters in here. How do you feel that you grew as a writer? How has this writing this book changed your perspective?
That's a really great question, because I think naturally as a writer, you want to improve with each novel. You know, this is my second novel, so you know, I'm still consider myself very much a fledgling novelist and writer, and I've lots of stories to tell. And I really felt I'd stretched myself again from, you know, I tackled the Titanic in my first novel, which my family thought I was crazy to even try to do that.
I bet it became a New York Times bestseller.
It did. So yeah, I think I'm possibly onto something there. Yeah, and again, it's just something I was extremely passionate about and really felt drawn to tell. The particular story I told in The Girl Who Came Home, and with A Memory of Violet again, just really wanted to explore, I suppose, the dynamic between sisters is a central theme in the novel. I have a sister myself, and to be able to tell the story from very different voices, that's what I really challenged myself with in this one. So we have two young and very illiterate, very uneducated little street children who are Irish. So some of that is told in the first person through Florrie's diary entries, and I had to really inhabit her and think how she would speak and how she would express herself.
Mm.
And then contrasting that with a relatively educated, you know, adventurous young lady, Tilly, who's 40 years further on in time from Florrie and Rosie. And then again contrasting that with Albert Shaw, who's, you know, this very sort of stiff Victorian man but obviously has a huge heart. And I loved the two different time periods in the novel. I love sort of weaving stories in and out of time periods and using different devices like letters and diaries and sort of creating that sense of smell and place in a novel. You know, the streets and the markets are such a ripe place to create, you know, sort of to pull on the reader's senses so that they can smell the flowers and they can hear the cobbles and the carts going over the cobbles in the rain.
Right.
So that was, it was quite a sensory novel to write from that point of view as well. So, yeah, I think it's just natural to want to try new things and to take yourself to different places, and that your readers will come with you.
Well, I think you did an awesome job. The language, flowers had a language all of their own in Victorian days. And, you know, my grandmother, was born in 1890. And so I'd hear all these stories, you know, from, because they used to be, they used to sell flowers and greengrocers, and it was all so different to today.
Mm.
But let's talk a little bit about that language of flowers that the Victorians were all familiar with. I didn't know this. One of my grandmother's favorite flowers was a pink carnation. And, you know, I have fond memories of going down her garden. She'd always have to show us her roses and what was blooming, but she'd always got pink carnations. So I know nobody likes carnations, but I have a fond memory of carnations. And I was really interested to read in your language of flowers that you cover in the book, too, that a pink carnation means I will never forget you.
Yeah, isn't it beautiful? And I just, you know, again, these wonderful things that you find when you start digging around in historical archives and this these lost traditions. And I just sort of stumbled across this, and through the flower sellers creating these little posies that they would call tussie mussies. And there were these little hand-tied posies with sort of lace and paper around them that ladies and gentlemen would obviously give to friends and lovers. But this incredible detail that went into the selection of which flowers you would give to somebody to express your emotion. And obviously, Victorian England, you couldn't just simply go up to somebody and say, I think you're great, you want to go for a drink. This had to be done very subtly, and it was often expressed through flowers. And I was really keen to incorporate this into the novel, and each of the four parts of the novel is prefaced by a particular flower, which relates to pressed flowers, dried pressed flowers that Tilly finds in this journal of florries. And the four flowers are a purple hyacinth, pink carnation, primrose and pansy. And each of those has a certain meaning. So as you said, pink carnation, I will never forget you. Primrose, I can't live without you. And this is really, I suppose, my way of letting us know how Florrie feels about having lost her little sister. And this language of flowers was so relevant to them. And it went into such incredible detail that there were actual floral dictionaries that, say, a young lady would refer to if she was receiving a bouquet of flowers from a young gentleman. Mm. She would have to literally look up the meaning of each flower to see what the overall meaning of this posy was. You can imagine if you got it wrong. So I think it's a beautifully romantic notion. You know, one we have a little bit of now, red roses for love, obviously. And the illustrations actually for each part of those four flowers, those beautiful sort of pencil illustrations in the book to depict each of those four flowers that had particular meaning to mm-hmm. Florrie and Rosie. And I just loved playing with that and weaving it into the novel. And obviously violets are a central theme, and the scent of violets, you know, they have a particular smell. Which is brought into the novel as well.
Right.
So it was just a hopelessly romantic and just one of those lost traditions that I love to think that maybe somebody reads my novel and now knows about the language of flowers and wouldn't have done before.
I think they will. And, for, you know, here's the one I just wanted to point out here. It was yellow rose, because you just talked about red rose, which we always think of love. Yellow rose, I've always thought of friendship, but it actually means, in the Victorian days, infidelity. So that was kind of interesting.
I know, the confusion. there were these actually beautifully illustrated floral dictionaries, you know, those very iconic sort of Victorian botanical drawings, they were called, of flowers, that people would peruse to see what their flowers meant. So just a lovely piece of history that right. You know, was really, really great to be able to weave into the book.
Right. Well, Hazel Gaynor, it's such a pleasure to have you back. I'm so pleased you had such fantastic success with your first novel. And I'm sure you're going to have even bigger success with this one. I can actually see this, you know, based on all the Downton Abbey furor that we've had lately. But, I mean, this would be a whole different subject, but I could see this as a TV series.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing? I think you'd hear the burst of excitement from Seattle, from Ireland, if that happened. How wonderful would that be?
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us. And a final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, Vicky. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you and to share some of the background to the book. If people would like to find out more about me, they can check out my website, which is hazelgaynor.com, and my Facebook page as well, which is Hazel Gaynor Books. And there's a little giveaway I'm running on there, which closes at midnight tonight, GMT. So a little bit more time for you guys to give away a signed copy of A Memory of Violets and my first novel,
Excellent.
The Girl Who Came Home. So
Excellent.
If people are interested, they could have a go at entering that as
okay.
well.
Okay, and we can link to all of that from hazelgaynor.com.
Absolutely, and thank you to everybody for listening. And if people read the book or have read the book, I really hope they enjoy it.
Great. Thanks for being with us. We want to just wish you all the best with that. You don't really need it, I'm sure. But there you go. We will be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Sit love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk, every Sunday morning beginning at 9 a.m. Thanks in part to best practitioner Dr. Nels Rasmussen, we cover the world of animals. This week, June 28th, it's an encore presentation of Animal World. Tune in to hear Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon in Seattle work their magic with harmonic energy shifting for callers and their animal friends. You could even receive a healing just from listening. Be sure to join us for Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and I'm very pleased to welcome back MJ Rose. She grew up in New York City. She's the author of more than a dozen novels, and her writings appeared in many magazines, including Oprah Magazine. She's been featured in the New York Times, Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, Time, USA Today. The list goes on. You've probably seen her on the Today Show, heard her on NPR. And, of course, our show. And she's also the co-president and founding board member of International Thriller Writers and the founder of AuthorBuzz.com. And her website is mjrose.com. And her latest novel is The Witch of Painted Sorrows. MJ Rose, welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
And you were quick to point out the irony of, you know, MJ Rose following the book A Memory of Violets and the Language of Flowers that we're just talking about. There's been a lot of coincidence around today's show. But anyway, welcome back. Is it fair to say that your latest novel is a gothic novel?
It totally is fair to say, yes. It's my first true, full gothic novel. And I loved writing it. I'm going to stick with gothic for a while. It's really, really fun to write about things like ghosts and witches. And I guess I want to be living in another time.
It's also fantasy at its best when you can really create, stuff that can't be proven, I guess, either way. I mean, it gives you great creative license, I would think.
Yeah, you know, I used to write contemporary suspense, and there certainly is a lot of people who are doing it very creatively. But I found that I was really getting, felt depressed by the reality of things, like nobody can really ever be lost if they have a cell phone. How many times can you write a scene where somebody runs out of battery, and the whole novel is based around the fact that they missed a connection because their cell phone wasn't working? All that kind of stuff was really getting to me, and I started writing a combination of past and present. And then this is The Witch of Painted Sorrows is my first completely set in the past novel without any present at all.
So let's talk a little bit about this story. I heard you say that the grandmother in the story, the protagonist, goes to Paris to flee her abusive husband, Benjamin. She goes to stay with her grandmother, or her grandmother. And I read that, or heard that you said that the grandmother character was inspired by your great-grandmother.
Yes, exactly. My great-grandmother was born in Paris in 1880 and came to New York around the time that the book takes place, 1894. She went when she was 14 years old and entered into an arranged marriage and went on to have 9 children. She also happened to be a self-proclaimed witch. And I didn't realize that when I started writing the book. I obviously knew it subconsciously, because when I started talking to an older cousin about my great-grandmother, I knew she told fortunes, because I have her crystal ball. And I was talking to a cousin while I was writing the book about my great-grandmother, and I said, you think she believed in witches? And my cousin wrote back, and she said, believed in witches. She called herself a witch. She thought she was a witch. She did witchy things. And I was fascinated on so many levels, but mostly that I had actually started writing a book without knowing consciously that my great-grandmother was a witch, and then in the process learned it. She was obviously not a broomstick, big hat witch, but she could help people. She could work with people and help them affect changes in people they knew and in themselves. You know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I think that what my book is really about, and the reason I really wrote this book, is I think that throughout history, strong, powerful women have always been considered bitchy or witchy, and that the nomenclature that we use to describe a certain kind of woman is horrendously unfair. And we have such a hard time still today dealing with creative, sexual women. We seem to need to put them in another category. Sadly, since the 1980s or 70s and 80s, we're trying to make women into good girls again in a really profound way. Not on TV, like Scandal and The Good Wife don't force women to do that. But in real life, we're really forcing women to do that. And this book is certainly fiction, and I hope it's a really good story, and it's totally entertaining. But at its heart is the idea that sometimes to get what you want, you have to tap into your inner witch, and that should be something that you're proud of doing, not something you're embarrassed to do.
Right, right. And so one of the things that you're known for is weaving in a real character into your books. And in this case, it was Gustave Moreau. So tell us a little bit about him, the real man, and why you included him in this story.
It's not on purpose that I've done that. It's odd. And there are a couple of books where I haven't. And lately I've been noticing that I have. It's weird. Other people notice things about your writing that you don't notice yourself.
Yeah.
But so what I do try to do is make as much of the book historically accurate as possible. And so Sandrine, who's my main character, comes to Paris in 1894, and she's a wife, a young wife, and she has an abusive husband, and she moves into her grandmother's house. And she wants to, as she becomes possessed by a witch, who's her ancestor, a 16th century courtesan, the ghost of a 16th century courtesan who was also a witch, Sandrine starts to explore her creative and her sexual side. And when she does that, one of the things that she starts doing is taking art classes. Paris in 1894 was the heart of the art world anywhere. We're talking about, you know, people are still impressionists, but the impressionists have been accepted. You have Monet painting, you have Renoir painting, Gustave Moreau is painting, Rodin is doing sculpture. You just have the most, Picasso's already painting. Henri Matisse is studying, Rualt is studying. It's one of the most astonishing times in art history. And so when I have Sandrine start to go to art school, I picked the main art school in the world at that time, which is the Salon the École des Beaux-Arts, which is still in existence and still very much one of the finest art schools in the world. And at that time, Gustave Moreau was teaching art there. Henri Matisse was one of his students. Rualt was another one of his students. And so I let Sandrine be one of his students either. In reality, the first woman that to attend the Ecole attended 2 years later in 1896, which is also astonishing that we're in Paris and Mary Cassatt is painting and Berthe Morisot is painting and their paintings are winning awards, and yet women aren't allowed to go to art school. If they want to study, they have to study at the atelier of an artist. So Gustave Moreau is a fascinating figure because he was a symbolist, and he was, I don't want to say he was into the occult, but he was very caught up in spiritualism. And so that really fit perfectly that I actually found somebody who could teach her, who was interested in the things that she was interested in for real. And his house is still in Paris. It's now a museum. And I spent quite a lot of time there. It's beautiful, if anybody's going to Paris. It is one of the most beautiful spiral staircases I've ever seen.
Mm. So you... let's talk a little bit about your protagonist in this. How did you develop Sandrine, and why move the locale to Paris? I couldn't think of a better city myself because I love Paris.
Well, I think I'm obsessed with Paris. I've written my last, this is my fourth book in a row that takes place in France. The fact that my great-grandmother was French, which is something that I didn't learn. I didn't know that my whole life. I only learned that about 10 years ago. And Paris had always been my favorite city. I decided I wanted to explore the city. And I think that part of the reason is that when you're in France, especially in Paris, or I shouldn't say especially, when you're in France, but let's talk about Paris, you can very easily walk around Paris and be transported back in time if you stick to certain sections, because most of Paris, the central part of the city, has changed very, very little in the last 120 years. The stores, obviously, who owns the stores are different, and the street traffic is different, and there are cars where there weren't cars before, there were very few cars, but the buildings are all the same. There's been very little, almost none, of tearing down the old to make way for the new. There are some new things that have happened, of course, like the Iampei pyramid in front of the Louvre. But other than that and what they've done to Léal, but it's very easy to walk around and just feel like you're steeped in history.
Yeah.
Every restaurant in the book that Sandrine goes to in 1894 is still in Paris now, and I went to. Every street she walks down really looks amazingly like what it would have looked like to her. So there are certainly other cities where that's true, but it's very easy in Paris to really feel the past. And I speak French, so I guess it's Paris instead of Rome or Barcelona, although I'm really dying to set a book in Barcelona and another one outside of England, outside of London. So... But for now, I don't seem to have been finished with Paris for a while. I still feel like there's more to do.
And so Sandrine is your main character. How did you develop her? I read that I think I heard you say that you write in somewhat of a fugue state. You'll sit and write for 2 or 3 hours and then read it back and you don't remember having written it.
Yeah, well, what I start to do is for about 3 months before I start writing the book, I make a journal for the main character, which is a book of collages with images and phrases and poems and writings and research that I put into this journal. And it's full of stuff. I mean, it has ribbons, it has pictures of things in museums, it has all kinds of strange and odd things. I call it procrastinate your way into writing a novel. Because I get to spend 3 months making up this whole little world in this journal, and I have all these rituals that make me sound really strange. You know, the journal comes from a certain store. I only use fountain pens. I only use three different color inks, depending on who the character is. And I have to find the journal that fits the character. I have to have her name before I start. I go through endless names. And by the time I'm done with the 3 months, I have a sense of who she is. And then I start writing the book. And I write for 3 hours a day in the morning at 6:30, listening to Gregorian chants, writing by hand in yet another kind of journal, kind I don't keep. And then at the end of the day, so I write in the morning from 6:30 to 9:30, and then at the end of the day, around 4 o'clock, I type what I wrote that morning. And I do that because the first time this happened was with a novel called Seduction, which is about Victor Hugo. And I wrote the whole book by hand in these journals. And then I got finished, and I called my agent, and I said, well, I'm done. Now you have to help me find somebody who can transpose all this writing and to type it. And he said, oh, I have somebody who can do that. And I said, great, who? And he said, you. He said, you have to type it yourself. That's how it's going to get edited. I said, I can't type it. It's going to take me 6 months to type it. He said, well, what are you doing for the next 6 months? You have 6 months before you have to turn the book in. So now I don't write the whole book and then type it. I type in the 2,000 words every night because that was torture, typing nonstop.
Right.
It turned out it took 4 months. I hated every minute of it. I mean, I love the book, but I hated just endlessly sitting there transposing what I'd written months before. When I do this, though, even at the end of the day or months later, when I do transpose it, I don't remember it. I don't remember having written it. And I've talked to other authors who've said the same thing, that we are writing in some kind of fugue state where a certain part of our brain is engaged, and we don't have a full conscious memory of what we've written until we read it back.
Right, right.
So that's... Sandrine is very much created. Oh, I also find pictures of the main characters from old drawings. And I have to find an old drawing that doesn't have a name on it. I mean, I can know the name of the artist, but it can't be a person named in the drawing, because then I would attach that name and who she was to the person.
Interesting.
Huh?
Well, you said it makes you sound crazy, and not at all, because I've talked with enough writers, and I have my own weird rituals to know that's part of the process, I think. So, always a pleasure talking with you. The book is called The Witch of Painted Sorrows. Your website is mjrose.com. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, MJ?
Yes, I'm having a contest for a pendant that's based on the book at my website, and if you join my newsletter by April 15th, then you'll be entered to win the pendant. It's labradorite, which is a very spiritual stone.
Awesome.
So I hope people go to my website and join my newsletter, and they'll be entered to win.
Awesome. And that's just initials mjrose.com, and there's a lot up there to read, and you can see MJ's other books up there. Thanks so much for being with us, MJ.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Take care. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And I want to thank each of you for joining us today. Always my favorite hour of the week, talking to you and bringing you guests who've got great stories. And I think both of our guests today had terrific stories to share with you. We'll be back next week. Until then, you can find me, if you have questions or comments, feedback on today's show, at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net, or at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. And you can also find me on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. Thanks so much for being with us. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
You've been listening to an encore edition of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Vicky returns live next week with a brand new show focusing on summer reading. Be sure and tune in every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.